Ben, we're picking up from last show. We didn't get to this quote from G.K. Chesterton that Marshall McLuhan used way back. Maybe I think he quoted it in the 30s in an article on G.K. Chesterton in 1936. This is the quote from Chesterton. "The highest use of the imagination is to learn from what never happened. It is to gather the rich treasures of truth stored up as much in what never was as in what was and will be." We, that's Chesterton saying as a medievalist or something, "we are accused of praising and even idealizing retrograde and barbaric things. What we praise is the progress which was for those retrograde things prevented, and the civilization that those barbarians were not allowed to reach. We do not merely praise what the Middle Ages possessed. It would be far truer to say that we praise, what they were never allowed to possess. But they had in them the potentiality of the possession. And it was that, capital letters, T-H-A-T, and it was that that was lost in the evil hour when all other possessions became a matter of scramble and pillage. The principle of the guild was a sound principle, and it was the principle and not only the practice that was trampled underfoot." And that's the end of the quote as far as McLuhan goes. Does that trigger off any ideas in reference to our revolution?
Two things. Until guilds are mentioned, I felt that it's a way of describing the ideal or the idea. And I suppose I have not that much sympathy with playing violins about the beauty of the idea, which doesn't work. It seems to me that too often people regret the fact that a good idea didn't happen. I mean, that was the middle. You see, during the quote, I had three different responses. When it began, I felt very enthusiastic and felt this is against positivism. This is against, because I studied history, and you have some people saying history is about establishing what happened when, and it's just describing this mountain that's already there, and you just go and map it, you know, past is just an unchanged block that you have to know backwards, and there's always somebody who knows more than you and you don't know as much, and you listen to this boring person telling you this happened. And so at the beginning of the quotation I felt very enthusiastic with its disagreement with positivism, its idea that we can find unfinished projects in the past, which is what for example Andrew Bergin, who's a big figure within the Stop the War Coalition, is trying to do at Houseman's Books near King's Cross, where he's trying to get people to come and talk about unfinished projects and ideas that didn't work in the past, because he can see that these are what we need at the minute. So I felt enthusiasm. Then I started to think, well, analytically, what is this ideal of the Middle Ages? It was barbaric, but they had an ideal. Well, that's Christianity, probably, isn't it? It's the idea we should all love each other, and the ideal. And then I felt less enthusiastic, because there always seems to be a handshake between the powers that be that do all the terrible things, and some sort of respect for an otherworldly good thing that we ought to have, this kind of trade-off. And I'd like to interrupt that and materially bring about something good. So I felt less enthusiastic. But then when you mentioned guilds, I got enthusiastic again, because it reminds me of a radical current in Europe. I'm thinking about Hützinger. What's his first name, Esther?
Johann
Hützinger, the Dutch theorist of play, Homo Ludens, and the waning of the Middle Ages. And his radical idea is that there was something in the Middle Ages that was lost when capitalism arrived and everything became rational and to do with accounting and money, and that it's worth preserving those things, and particularly talking about guilds, about certain kinds of social organisation which happened in the past, which maybe didn't come to fruition. And then I got excited again just at the end. It was an interesting composition. It kind of started off sympathetic, it went through a kind of dodgy area, and then at the end there was a little fillip which I liked.
Well, is it because it's a broad idea paragraph? Do you have that experience with most idea philosopher thinkers? Do you do that sine wave?
Not at all. It's because I'm listening to you speak it because I'm having to follow it like music. I'm responding to it like music. I mean, I hope people who are listening to this are responding to us in this way. It's a very interesting way that not many people have thought about. Because when you read, you are in control. You are not being subjected to somebody else's rhythm. Your eye moves across the page and you absorb as much as you like, and then you can go back and you're in control. When you're listening to somebody speak, you're not in control in that way. You are being massaged by something. You are being lifted up and let down and agreed with and disagreed with. So what I mean is that hearing an idea from you like that, I was thinking of it musically.
Okay, you know, I was thinking about the quote I brought up from the Miles interview with Zappa in the fall of 69, August, September 69, where I brought up last week where the word idea in capital letters is said. And I was trying to remember, did Miles say that word idea, or did Frank say it? Do you recall?
I'm afraid I don't. I can't think of that at all.
I think Miles said, is there an idea, some framework or something that holds all this together? And I'm not sure. I think Frank, I know he says in the interview at some point, he says, that may come from my subconscious, but I'm not aware of it. No, we need to find that interview. Check it out just then. Because I just have, as we're talking about idea, it's interesting. Because how do you see this quote relate to Frank talking about Verez? Isn't he saying, you guys suppressed Verez, we could have had incredible work from this guy, but you forced him to quit, and so I'm celebrating what never happened. Is there some connection there?
Absolutely. I mean, that's really all you can do, isn't it? I mean, if you really want to affect something, you look at unfinished projects. I mean, the people who try and base themselves on the greats are always lame hacks, because they take their strength from something that's already completed, and what more is there to do? There's nothing to do with it. And in looking at Verez, Frank was talking about his own immediate understanding as an adolescent and as a drummer of ionization, of a percussion piece, that he understood that musically straight away. As far as I can, you know, hearing it, he didn't say, oh, this is a bit of difficult music I ought to work on. He liked it a lot straight away. And he was kind of absolutely amazed that when he played it to his friends, a lot of them went, why are you playing me this weird music? And they couldn't see what he saw in it. So then he learned a bit more about Verez, and then found that he had a very difficult time in his environment, that he wanted to do this kind of music in the classical world, and because of the way that classical music had developed, particularly in the United States, where the whole idea of classical music is some idea of something classy and to do with wooden instruments and vintage instruments and something looking back towards the past, of recalling the past, that this absolutely ultra futuristic idea of what sound could do, this doesn't fit in the classical world. And so I think Frank honed in on this as a kind of crack in the usual way in which culture stacks up. And that's exactly where people who want to do something like cracks, they want to get in there, you know. I mean, this is sexual and it's creative. It's where you can put something in that you can make a difference, that you can change things.
Yes, I think of the last line of Finnegan's Wake. The keys to given. The given aspect is the given what has happened. Is joy seeing through the given, or hijacking the given, accepting the given? That's what comes to mind, since we're relating Joyce, Zappa, and ourselves and the revolution. Does that trigger off anything? What happened is the given, right?
So you think the given is... is the past seen as this kind of positivist block, this mountain that's unchanged? But the bit that interests me is the crack in it that might be the product of tectonic forces which are pushing this way and that way, and the fact that yeah, a volcano erupted here is a fact, and I'm not against facts, and I'm not flying in the face of the facts, but I want to understand what these tensions are that produce explosions and cracks, and in order to be able to look at the present and see that that's not seamless either, that the idea that the past is simply settled and we just go and find out about it fits in with an idea that the present is pretty settled and everything will go on as it always does. Whereas the other point of view, and I think the revolutionary point of view, is that everything is in conflict and everything is full of contradictions and spaces which where things don't quite fit together, which is where you yourself can insert your activity and your intentions to change things.
Yes, what you just described as your preference is obviously what Joyce, to me, does. And so it's interesting what the given is. And then you think of W.B. Yeats' song, The Circus Animal's Desertion, which was a poem that McLuhan quoted a lot in his book From Cliched Archetype, about he talks about his fame and where he's arrived, but he doesn't know what to do, so he just goes back to the rag and bone shop of the heart where the ladders begin and start over. But he says it begins with a mound of refuse. And remember, there's the midden heap. That's the given in Finnegan's Wake, the midden heap.
And it's very important to think of one's cultural inheritance as a midden heap rather than as shiny monuments of that you need to treat with respect. That this, it's almost like dreams that you can have of piles of ordure, or that this understanding of the past and of your inheritance as this waste ground actually expresses a really important subjective reaction, which I think everybody has, which is everything outside themselves is boring. The only really interesting thing is their own little toe and the funny crinkled nail on it. That is the most interesting thing that is. And to repress that and pretend otherwise is always to produce a kind of falseness which is basically untrue, but also very, very boring to think. And so this connection with yourself of understanding that the whole thing is a midden heap until you start going through it and sifting it and doing things with it and changing it and making things, that's the bit that's exciting, that it's your own activity that's exciting. And so people who try and educate other people or educate children by enforcing a respect for culture, if only you would accept that Beethoven is a great composer, it seems to me are going in absolutely the wrong direction. That respect actually kills everything, and it's the ability to realize that it's all equal, that a stimulus for yourself may come from rubbish or the discarded, that is crucial. And you find time and time again that the people who produce something interesting are the people who paid attention to the disregarded.
Yeah. I mean you present a lot of garbage on your show, but they're your favorites, but they're not your toe. They are your favorite records, your favorite band, your favorite axes to grind.
Well, I do bring my children onto the show, and I think of them as extensions of my toes. So they're mine, you know, they're part of me sort of fiddling around with my stuff, and insofar as I that kind of stuff is my own lips and my own tongue, and you know, so it's my own stuff. But I do also have the idea that once you've presented something theoretically like that, it'd be very the kind of way in which art seems to work is that somebody will go, oh, that's the idea, and then they'll do a really boring 2-hour show of just them going, you know what I mean? The problem with finding an idea is always somebody runs off with the idea who does just that idea, and then you think, well, that's a daft thing to do, and that was pretty dull. So I'm quite wary of this finding solutions in any one idea and wanting to fold it in with a kind of indignation with that idea as well. It's opposite, you know, of trying to find my way back to being able to recite William Wordsworth as well.
Yeah, I have some new, exciting news. This is an example of me presenting my subjectivity. On March 18th, out of the blue, a fantastic new medium dropped into my life, equal to the evergreens. So on March 22nd, I had a three-hour conversation with James Joyce about the composing of Finnegan's Wake.
And how were you getting in touch with James Joyce if it wasn't via the evergreens?
Well, that's the point. A new person showed up as a medium and is equal in abilities as the evergreens. That I never expected. And they proved it. We had a session on March 18th, not recorded, just happened sort of spontaneously. That was amazing. I talked to McLuhan. I talked to some other characters. And then on March 20th, we did a recording and talked about some issues that my wife and I are involved in and all kinds of stuff that went on for a couple hours. Then on March 22nd, Sunday night, Carolyn was with me, but she had to go to bed. She heard the beginning. But in the course of while the medium was in trance, the medium, a totally unrelated topic apparently, said Finnegan's Wake. And so I said, well, Finnegan's Wake, you just said that. Does that mean that I can talk to James Joyce? And they said, yes. And then I started to talk to him. And I got this incredible detail about his life from him, about the struggle of making Finnegan's Wake. It's incredible. I got all on recording. But Carolyn told me the next day, she only heard the first half hour or something. She said, and she couldn't talk to me, comment while I was doing it as she was leaving. But she said the next day, she says, that was incredible. He talked so casually and intimately and personally. She said it was even flowed better than the evergreens when I used to talk to Joyce through the evergreens. So here's this particular experience I have, very personal, very subjective, maybe real, who knows? I don't know, maybe it was a tape recording I talked to, but it doesn't present itself that way. Don't know what it is I talked to, but it was incredible. And what I found out is that Joyce had, I have not read Ellman's biography in detail, only touched on it. Have you read Richard Ellman's biography on Joyce?
Yeah, I read it ages ago and I've forgotten it all, but yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't recall anybody saying that Joyce had a dog. Do you remember that?
No, I never thought of him as a dog man.
Right, and so apparently he had a terrier, but he pointed out the name of the dog was Bobby. And so I made a lot of hay out of that, because I claimed in the course of the conversation it got to the point where I was claiming
but you were that dog.
Yes, that I in the Finnegan's Wake Society of New York, we did in the 90s for 7 years, we would go through every line, right, the group of 20 to 30 people, and analyze it and figure out and bring in suggestions and go through the annotations by Roland McHugh. And we're saying this Finnegan's Wake stuff just for Ed's purposes, you know, we're supposed to talk about Finnegan's Wake, so as well as my own subjective situation. But every now and then I'd exclaim to the group, oh, this is all about me. And eventually this old dentist got really angry and he told me, if I hear one more statement from you about this is about you, that's it. Well, he died 3 weeks later, so I was able to carry on. Nobody else objected.
Uh-huh.
So I've maintained, I think I say it in Up the Orfianti, the essay where you're mentioned back in 95 as the Ben Watson Collective, I maintained that the book does anticipate me and Carolyn and what we're doing. And so I couldn't help but bring this up.
Uh-huh.
James Joyce.
Well, you see, Bob.
Let me just finish. I was claiming to be the leading extension of what he had done, and I said the fact you had a terrier named Bobby was predicting that, just like you predicted McLuhan on page 254 of Finnegan's Wake. That whole paragraph, and he goes, "Yes, it took me 3 weeks to compose that paragraph," and so we were talking about the synchronicities and archery of language. I've just used up 3-4 minutes with my own personal favorites or talking about myself. Is that fit the revolution here?
Well, I'm a bit confused about your revolution, actually, Bob, because I don't know whether, modelling yourself on the rather more famous Bob Dobbs, your idea of the revolution is to have your words or your personality or your face or your image, you know, imprinted on every t-shirt, which seems to me not really a revolution but more like marketing, you know, marketing which has its sinister side. I mean, I think Adolf Hitler was the victory of marketing in politics.
Let me respond to that point. First of all, what do you mean the more famous Bob Dobbs? Who's that?
Oh, the Church of the Subgenius Bob Dobbs.
Oh, no. I never attached myself to that. That was created by them. That's what's funny. I certainly am anonymous.
But this will to fame, this will to power, this...
which I don't have.
Yeah, exactly. And I want to emphasize that or suggest to you that side of how you're thinking, because the part of talking to you that really excites me, I'm just thinking of how we looked at a bus shelter which had been overtaken by Virgin's new attempt to make money out of the internet and the kind of things
YouTube,
that they're kind of presenting your culture, your ideas, your all the rest of it, but somehow by some kind of magic of commerce they've sort of got it so that it's not yours, you have to pay them to get it. And we were laughing about this. And at that moment your analysis and the way you were thinking and the way you were talking about various Hollywood films deciding they're all about yourself, it seemed to me that yourself had become a kind of cipher, that it wasn't really you weren't really saying that me, this passport holder or this property owner, it's all coming to me. You were saying me as every man. It's all about me as every man, that everything is all about us all the time. And if we could get to that perception, if we could understand how universalized subjecthood has become in this capitalist mediated system, how common everything is, we would actually get rid of a lot of the illusions which keep people in this extremely tedious idea of competition versus everybody else. And it's that side of what you're saying that really excites me.
Yeah, and like I do this show under another name, Bob Neverett, Cashflow, and I made an amazing manifesto today. I don't recommend people listen to it. It'll scare them. It'll bother them what they hear I say. But it was very important to my revolution, what I'm doing. I have a sentence I wrote, notes for today's show, not our show, but the Cash Flow, which I do earlier on Wednesdays. HCE is a consultant to everyone else in the info plantation. You see... You follow that? HCE, here comes everybody, is a consultant to everyone else in the info slavery or plantation. We're in an info slavery exchange. And that is what the revolution's got to deal with. Now, I say a breakthrough technology like, quote, cold fusion, unquote, would get us out of the tyranny of communication. We're in a hyper-communication world. And that is one of the strategies or... motifs that I'm wrestling with as we plan the revolution. There is nothing wrong with the world right now in so many levels. If you accept human behavior as it's always been, but maybe there could be a new kind of human behavior, which you glimpsed when you were in Paris or wherever it was in France in 82 with the commune, and that affected you. And so whatever it was you glimpsed, I don't know if that applies to the new situation, but you did think something could be different. You do operate on the principle that humans could not act the way they've been.
Yeah.
You can comment on that.
I'm trying to get back to the beginning of what you said, but it was a long...
Let's go back to the given. The given... the keys to given. Now, that's interesting. Joyce is saying, do we see through the given? Is the given the endless repeat of human behavior? It's always the same, you know, birth, marriage, death, tragedy, kids, usually tragedy, and problems happen, and you don't usually die happy. And if you are not happy, you've drugged yourself into some insensate state, you know. I mean, if you don't know you're not happy, then you've drugged yourself in some silly way. I don't live like this. I never had any children. I guess I got married, but it was an odd marriage. So, and I don't plan on dying, as you'll hear in my manifesto. So I'm trying to be a prototype for something new. So I laugh at the markings of success. I'm not involved with that. I mean, whatever degree of fame I have, that's enough, and I don't want it. And I got other stuff to do, which is make sure you people never become famous again, something like that. Or if you do become famous, to be able to make it a small part of your life. Mm. Very small part. Is that, are you following? Am I stimulating you?
Yeah, I'm trying to get back to the...
Whatever it was.
Whatever it was, but I don't think I'm getting there.
you forgot there.
Yeah, well, the I'm trying to sift the... Well, I'm trying to sift out what I like about what you're saying from the reactionary chaff. You know, I'm trying to get to the bit that turns me on. I'm trying to isolate that and tell you what it is so that you know what I'm getting from you. And it's partly the... without boundaries, looking at human activity and culture so that we're not stuck up some gum tree of we only look at this or we only look at that, that anything can be looked at. And that's, I suppose, why we're calling this Karl Marx meets Marshall McLuhan over the oeuvre of Frank Zappa. We're calling these discussions because Frank Frank Zappa gives us the call to look everything squarely in the face and not say that's too shabby for me, as Matt Groening once summarized it, or that's too snobby for me. You know, we're going to go everywhere. We will look at everything. And okay. And
let
that...
Let me respond to that. Let me respond. I just want to say that I think before any interpretation of Frank, I just love his music. Which I'm going to send you some point what I said 20 years ago after seeing three concerts in February 88 in New York City on this last tour. And I was saying, listening to what I said on the radio, that even Bob Dobbs needs an acoustic release and Zappa gives it to me. The meaning or the other stuff, I don't look at Frank. I look at him, but I love the effect he has as his music. I mean, I say all this technology, which has a lot of disservices, was all worth it because it allowed Frank Zappa to exist.
Mm-hmm. But, you see, what is music? People think you say music and they know what it is, but when you really talk to anybody, you always find that their idea of what music is completely different from your own, and you end up talking about everything. That music is not a specialised subject. It's definitely something which isn't conceptual or verbal that affects us straight away, which is why people who think a lot about music tend also to think a lot about sex and the animal parts of us, because we're dealing with something which is not a decision made in concepts and words. We're able to deal with a world that affects us, which is not words. But of course, everybody is able to deal with a world which is not words, because everybody gets up in the morning and pushes their bed covering away and staggers off to wash their face or what have you. I mean, we're dealing with non-verbal things all the time. But music seems to be a bridge for people to think about, that allows people to think about the non-verbal in a way that most other areas of thinking activity tend to isolate you in particular, you know, you learn a particular set of terms and then you're able to repeat them. And the discussions of music, and I mean, I found this invariable. I mean, is this true of your experience, that you're having a very boring time at a party and you meet someone, you start talking about music and everything becomes alive? And I don't think that's just my own penchant for music as a specialised activity. I think it's because music represents a bridge for people between a human intention and the world which is not covered by language.
Yeah, no, that's true. But and isn't it, people like to talk about what entertains them, so it's not just limited music. But you're saying that music does have this extra thing of getting you out of the nonverbal. Like if you talk about authors, you're still in the verbal. It's getting out of the verbal.
It gets you out of the verbal, but there's still a very strong idea of what's correct or not correct. It's not like, well, we got out of the verbal, so now it's all sunsets and we can just look at them and appreciate the big artist in the sky or something. That people have incredibly intense opinions about music. Even though, I mean, it's quite paradoxical. It's outside concepts and language, so it doesn't really fit into politics or usual systems of argument. And yet people absolutely know that they like this piece of music and they don't like that piece of music, and there's reasons why. And when that discussion starts, my ears prick up, because I think there's some kind of breaking of a certain barrier going on, the usual barrier between where language is allowed to be and where sort of life beyond language is allowed to be.
But you're saying that it's a boring party, and then music will allow you to have interesting conversations or interesting verbal activity.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's paradoxical. I'm not saying you solve a boring party by playing very loud music. In fact, that's usually the way of producing incredibly boring parties, where you have very loud music and no one can talk to each other. No, it's talking about music that interests me, the challenge of talking about music, the impossibility of it, and the fact that you can. I mean, there's some boring quote which Frederick Jameson got all upside down in a book, and I was indexing it, and I think I indicated it and it got changed, but he got it wrong, and he said talking about music is like it's the dancing about architecture, frozen anyway, it doesn't really matter. But
so what was his point, and you disagree with what he was saying about talking about music?
It was just the cliche that somehow talking about music is obviously idiotic, you know, that it's like dancing about architecture, whatever that quote is. Whereas for me,
here's
talking about music is the only point, because this is why it interested me to you were asking me what I thought of an idea, the quote that we began with from G.K. Chesterton. What did I think of this idea? And I had to register the fact that I'd gone up and down and around while the idea was being expressed, that I couldn't think of the idea as a single, you know, name on a voting slip where I had to tick here or tick there. You know, I was forced to think about your idea as an experience that I'd been through. And music reminds people that things are an experience you're going through. They're not simply a set of options in which you already know what you tick and what you don't tick because you're that kind of person. That it's, I'm talking about the politics of experience. I'm talking about experience as being the real thing that we want to understand.
Yeah, I noticed in probably last week's show, your show, you said tactility versus maybe repression, something like that. And I've noticed that, I don't know this, but it seems that you're using the word tactility more since we met last April. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a Bob word, as far as I'm concerned.
So I like the way you use it, and I wanted to say that McLuhan said that language was tactile. So when you talk about music, language is the best medium to talk about music because it's really tactile. It's not just oral or logocentric or verbal. So I want to point out that language speaking is a tactile experience.
And
so
translation from one realm into the other is, for me, the most exciting thing. That people who say, well, all you can do with music is, if you hear music, then you might whistle something or you make other music, you know, that everything's in a stream. What interests me is going at right angles to a medium and saying, well, no, the most interesting thing you can do with music is talk about it.
Yeah, and actually, if speech is tactile, is there? McLuhan used to say conversation is the best. Like McLuhan would say, or Zappa would say, music is the best. And McLuhan says conversation is the best. When, if you think of it, is there anything? Could any amazing future technology? You know, we'll get holograms that we can have sex with and all that stuff. Will it be as great as talking to someone? Do you know what I mean? Face to face. Will it be as comprehensive as the ESP and language gesture goes on? Will conversation, in the end, always be the greatest human invention?
The greatest human invention is talking with an awareness of, here comes everybody. When that was a thing which I wanted to come back to you about here comes everybody. Because another word for here comes everybody is Freud's idea of the superego. And what I think Freud, my interpretation of Freud's superego, is being aware of all the other people who might hear what you're saying. And it seems to me that statements grow in stature and intensity the more the person who's saying thinks about all the different people who might hear what they're saying. And the least interesting things that people say are said to just one little layer in society or just a few people who will get it. And the being aware of what everybody else might think about what you're saying is beginning to face the totality. And I don't think tactility means anything without the totality.
No, tactility is the orchestration of totality, or is totality, no difference. As you say this, I think of, that's obviously what Joyce was showing. And Zappa was showing through the musical medium, and well, his music was anything. So his interviews were part of his music. But when I think of this totality, if you don't understand that, then you don't understand why Frank did what he did or what Zappa did. I'm not sure about Lewis. He might have been the contrarian, the natural contrarian to this. Had a very interesting discussion about the relationship with Joyce and Lewis with Joyce. That's a side thing, hold it off. But the this totality, that's what great art is. And so Zappa took...
And it's what great revolutions are. I mean, revolutions are moments where a whole society is going to understand what it is in relation to history and other societies, and everybody becomes aware of where they really are, rather than just carrying on because that's the only way you can carry on. The decisions are made in the light of some kind of larger perspective. It's that larger perspective arriving, which is the real kick.
So the internet and all that we have today digitally is an amazing expression of the totality, but it's caused an incredible crisis for cultural and local identity. Is conversation better than the internet? Maybe if you have the internet to share and talk about as you go through a conversation. I don't know. The revolution caused by the latest technologies is pretty revolutionary, but again, it's not the revolution that you're talking about. It's not the whole revolution that you're talking and pining for or hoping for.
No,
it's like Esther, you know, prompted the workers there at some place or university to get a decent fee. So that is an interesting activity. And is that what we should be doing? Helping the janitors get better money? Is that the revolution?
Well, I think a revolution has to be fighting for your own urges. I don't think it's charity. I don't think you can do something for other people, that kind of... you know, patrician, we ought to care about the people down there. I don't think that ever works. It's usually hypocritical, and I get worried when people are thinking like that. That I think that it has to be, the revolution has to be an expression of your own desires, of your own need to develop your own self. And for me, the revolution I'm interested in is very bound up with the ability to think and to discuss and to have dialogue, and
Man, your revolution is, man, everybody's talking and thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
But aren't they doing that?
But no, because there is everything's so divided that everybody thinks they're in some specialism where we have to keep all these other people out and these other considerations out, or we have no status. So, I mean, an example of this was at the point in my career where I nearly became a kind of professional commentator on jazz. I was a jazz person. And luckily, this never actually transpired. I didn't get the job on Radio 3, and I didn't get the gig here and the gig there, and I didn't become a jazz writer. And I'm very glad it didn't happen, because people who restrict themselves to jazz and become experts on jazz become incredibly stupid, because they don't understand things from the point of view of the creators of jazz, who weren't trying to do jazz. They were trying to do extraordinary music, which they hope would reach everybody. And you read interviews with Charles Mingus or Duke Ellington, they hate that word. It's ghettoizing them. It's a stupid word. It's horrible. They don't celebrate jazz. The only people who celebrate jazz are people making money out of talking about it. And this restriction on discussion, this inability of people to talk as here comes everybody, this excluding here comes everybody, of wanting to be in a thinking that it improves the level of discussion to be a specialist who can't talk about what everybody's thinking or all the considerations that should be done, actually ties down discussion and destroys it and puts us all in these nets which prevent us moving, and it's very restrictive. And so I want revolution from the point of view of wanting to be able to talk and think and let my ideas go wherever I want. So it's a completely selfish, my reason for wanting a revolution. It's not worrying about the other people, it's worrying about my own ability to think and talk, because there is no possibility of thinking without recognizing everybody's right to think and answer you.
Well, what if they start responding by grabbing you and pulling your pants down at a bus stop? That's a response. That's linguistic. Where do you sort of, I think people juggle, yeah, we can talk, but what if I start doing something? What if I start, I grab Ace in your house and I get all worked up and I grab Esther and start, pronging her up against the wall? You might go with that, you might not. But that is what everybody's on guard for behavior that sort of sparks violent emotions. You know what I mean? So the policing mechanism of normal interactivity in a small tribe is okay, but how do you police people now? And if we've got people who talk about on their MySpace page, they got a whole list of all this variety of things they're interested in, and they list it all, and they talk about it, and they find other people to talk about it. It sounds like we're already getting what you want. I know it isn't what you thought you want, but people are talking about all kinds of things that they never had a chance to talk about in person.
Yeah, I mean, one's own circle is restricted, and there are specialist things you get involved in. It's very important to, for me to sit in Somerstown in London and talk to you in Maui, Hawaii, through Skype and through this technology, and being able to find someone who can extend your ideas, and that finding your the things that stimulate you is a necessary part of one's development. But that has always happened, whatever the technology. That is pretty basic, to human activity. It's not true, say, that in the Middle Ages everybody just worked in their valley. They had the church, which gave them an idea of Christendom and of Rome, and of Jesus was there, and Saint Peter, and one day they might go to Rome, and this imagination about the whole world is something that the Middle Ages had to have. It wasn't an isolated, restricted you know, kind of rural idiocy all the time. It had this idea, which was the idea, you know, was the, which I think G.K. Chesterton was talking about. It was an idea of a united society of what the Catholic Church was saying it was going to achieve.
We're talking to Joyce through this new medium. What he did to solve his anxiety about how he was composing Finnegan's Wake and what it was and the pressure and how everybody thought he was nuts, he consulted mediums a lot, which would violate, you know, your Hugh Kenners and professors of secular humanism that think Joyce is this literate guy doing this, if they knew that he was going around with gypsies. Now, I brought...
No, it is well known that he became quite superstitious when writing Finnegan's Wake and started to think that he was encoding prophecy and, I mean, that's in the Richard Ellman, I think.
Okay, but what happened is that Nora, according to Joyce, the Joyce I was talking to, Nora was so frightened, like I said, did she go to the mediums? And he said, no, she was so frightened of the mediums, she preferred to think I was off having affairs than to think I was talking to the demons or whatever. So she thought, made herself think that Joyce was having affairs all over the place because she couldn't handle the fact that he was actually talking to spirits. So that was interesting. And then there was another thought. I don't remember it, but it should come up again. Okay, so the other thing about what he said, which was pretty interesting. He was amazed. He's amazed at what goes on YouTube. He says, you know, back in my day, what I did was pretty outrageous. But now, you got everybody's on there on the YouTube taking their clothes off and screwing each other and broadcasting it. And he says it's absolutely incredible the way it is now. And so I said, well, but the thing is with Finnegan's Wake, you outdid all the outrageous behavior that was going to unfold as we moved into the latter part of the 20th century and into the first part of the 21st century with the new expressive media, as McLuhan called it. You outdid it because you created something so incomprehensible, so ridiculous, so useless, that you one-upped all the silliness that goes on YouTube, and he didn't demur.
Well, that's it, Bob. I mean, you know, you get to these points through all sorts of means that I'm not going to argue with you about, but don't convince me, but you arrive at exactly the point I'm at, which is finding Finnegan's Wake still the most objectionable, prickly, odd thing that I've ever seen. And it remains that despite all the advances of this and that and the other and the enthusiasms that sweep through populations and makes one look askance at the cyber boosters and the enthusiasts for the latest idea of technological consumerism. And it's that which you see, the reason I like talking to you is that you put Zappa and Joyce, you mention them in the same breath, and there are very few people who do that. And when I listen to Bongo Fury and Captain Beefheart is reciting words written for him from Zappa about a cheap exploitation film they both saw when they were teenagers, and he goes, the puffed and flabulent rubber goods mask, and they know that the words that they're saying, I mean, you know, the acolytes can go and work it all out afterwards and interview people and they think they know what it is, but the whole point about it is that it is something absolutely inscrutable to someone expecting to hear a Beach Boys song. That's the point of it, is this knobbly, gnarly, gritty, incomprehensible thing, which is so exciting to hear. And why is it such a relief to hear for certain people? It's such a relief to hear that. It's beautiful to me. It's, in its ugliness, it's absolutely beautiful that that should exist and then actually be in record shops and actually fight the Beach Boys and the Sting and these people who seem to be saying all the good things, and it's so golden and it's so boring, and suddenly this gnarly bit of incomprehension hurled your way on purpose is brilliantly exciting. And that's the connection I find between what Finnegan's Wake is and what Beefheart and Zappa did.
Yeah, and
Was that your own bit of gnarly stuff?
Yeah, I had to hold back the cough so all your gems weren't ground out, so I waited. I was going to say, McLuhan said did exactly what your little ascetic doctrine there you said about 2 minutes ago and then elaborate on. It's exactly McLuhan's. Everybody would get excited about LSD or all the latest stuff, and he'd always say, "Well, that was already done by Finnegan's Wake, and there's a lot more in Finnegan's Wake." He always referred back to Finnegan's Wake, which is what you're saying. In other words, he found it amazing, the Finnegan's Wake, and it was amazing that people didn't get it or appreciate it. Okay, that's one level I wanted to respond with, and then on the other thing, yes, the difference that Zappa offered, the uniqueness. I don't know if I went to a London concert and saw Jim McDougal or something, you tell me that people get terrified when he's up on stage, right?
Why are we suddenly talking about Jim McDougal of Ape Shit?
Because he's someone who does something strange. For most people, I think. So you told me about him, how you even said that you like his performance because he's on the, you don't know if he's going to shoot somebody or something.
Yeah.
That's similar to throwing something. This woman is celebrating me now, making YouTubes of me, and she smothers herself after Eris, you know, the goddess of anarchy or whatever she was, and she threw the apple in among the gods and just got them all fighting over the apple because it said, whoever gets me is the prettiest one, and caused chaos. So she sees what I do as the principle of Eris. She's a member of Discordianism. I don't know if you know about that. That's Robert Anton Wilson world. But let me just finish. So Zappa threw an Eris apple in the scene. And that's what we seem to like. And it sounds like Jim McDougal does this.
Well, I think there are many differences. The particular block to comprehension that I'm appreciating is very deliberately constructed by Zappa and Beefheart. It's a very it has its own internal logic, and when you get involved with it, you can unpick it. It's not the same as just being nihilistic. It's not a nihilism.
Okay, I got this is Gurdjieff's idea. I don't know if you ever read Gurdjieff, but he said there's objective art and there's subjective art. Objective art is designed with particular effects that the artist knows will be caused. It's like Zappa to me back then struck me as a Gurdjieffian artist, whereas Bob Dylan is a subjective artist. He's just expressing his dilemma. He's good at it, or it makes sort of sometimes good music, but he's not doing objective art. And McLuhan always talked about objective, or not those terms, but he said the artist is interested in the effects it wants. He knows what he's doing to you, and he knows you need it. And so there was Zappa doing McLuhan. And then I think Joyce was doing that. So I agree. It's not the subjective nihilistic projection, even though you in your ideology talk about subjectivity. But actually, you're talking about objectivity, aren't you? An objective art?
Of course. I mean, if you're going to face the tribunal of totality, you better be pretty objective.
No, okay, so you don't, yeah, you see, that's a good distinction. We've arrived at an important point here of whether we're on the same page or not. You see Jim McDougal as, you know, nihilistic, subjective. It's interesting, but not well orchestrated.
No, that's not true. I mean, Jim McDougal exists within very framed circumstances of post-Throbbing Gristle and Mad Pride and so on. And within those frames, I think that his actions have been extremely aware of how he's perceived and what he's doing. So, no, I'm a great fan. I think he's, you know, a great artist.
Well, why were you surprised they brought him up then?
Because from your point of view, I find it amazing that you should leap from one to the other.
No, you say from my point of view. What you mean? You don't mean from my point of view. You mean just that I do it.
No. From your from the perspective of Bob Dobbs, understanding Jim McDougal just seems really bizarre. Maybe that's what we should lead off next week, because we're coming to the end of Bob and Ben Go Head to Head here.
And they can go listen to your today's Out to Lunch show for more detail about me. You wrestle with me in that, right?
Yeah, I do. I do. If you want to wrestle with Bob Dobbs some more, I've been talking about him elsewhere, but we'll be on again next week, won't we, Bob?
Yeah, I think it was. I love the fact we got to the subjective art, and then we're not sure what we mean by it, but it's good. Very interesting.
Well, for me, it was a fairly ropey show, but it definitely has its flashes that make me want to do it again next week.
It always will.
Cheers then. Bye, Bob.
Bye, Ben. Thanks a lot.